I think it's tied primarily to the amount of money invested in the field. So again, you got people misnaming things. And common, especially, I've mentioned it before, when it comes to physics, it's all over the damn place. You know, I mean, we had a 50-50 chance of getting a current flow correct, and we chose to point it in the opposite direction. The current flow in a diagram is not flow of electrons through a conductor, but the flow of particles of some theoretical nature. So, again, you can't rely on English. English is not the greatest way to deal with science, and it constrains human understanding regularly.
KD2FRU?
Yes, George.
I believe the terminology artificial intelligence was derived by the people who are putting together all the algorithms and all the complex reflections on different many computer bases, whatever it is. It was to induce two things: fear of it or confidence in it. And I do believe that the terminology was targeted.
Well, I don't know. I mean, historically, it goes all the way back even to the time before. There's a great mathematician who did a lot of work on a Turing test that I think you might have heard, which is an experiment to see if computer algorithms could simulate a human being's thought process just by people asking the computer questions and receiving the answers. Ever since there was any kind of intelligence device like you know, brain, ENIAC, you know, any of those.
Electronic enumerator integrator and computer, 1948, yes. Understood. But I believe that they targeted by putting together the terminology artificial intelligence. They wanted to see how much they can get out of people's reactions in the positive or negative direction.
Go on, please.
Just that was my comment, KD2FIU. Thank you, Roy.
So let's wait for him to come back.
And Jim, I don't know if you understood what I was saying here. They want us to think both ways. Fear it or you.
Sorry, I got
to I think the most important thing isn't what I think. It's recognizing that what we're talking about is a highly relevant topic of great importance. That's my main thought at the moment.
Roy's back.
This is AC2GS. Sorry, I fell off of All Star. Look, Turing, I don't think Turing was a public relations guy. He wrote a lot of sophisticated subjects, and one of them was simulating intelligence from an artificial source such as a computer. So, you know, there are people legitimately dedicating their lives into ability to kind of manifest a intelligence-like response out of non-biological systems.
82FIU input again.
You want me to repeat myself?
No, no. I was asking for input.
From who?
Roy, when you got dropped off, there was some people in there. I'm not sure. I'm sorry. I'll stand by. Well, no, I'll stand by. KD2FIU.
I heard a comment.
Okay, what?
Yeah, thanks, yeah. Would you like to drive the car that is highly unpredictable? And it's surprising you every time you sit on it and try to drive it. That's artificial intelligence. Close to junk, but not the junk. Yet. And to exceed.
Well, I mean, you could have something that responds randomly, and you could just say it's a terrible case of artificial intelligence, I guess. But the whole concept is to improve, get the quirks out of them, and have them simulate a truly intelligent living being. So that's kind of the end stage. And again, that's, I'm talking about the legitimate, you know, 1950s plus scientists, not particularly the trillion-dollar crazy people, the neural variant hucksters out there that are kind of trying to out Elon. But unfortunately, since $1 billion, they're the ones who the reporters listen to the most. You know, again, you watch YouTube, there are IT guys who are very smart, who are completely taken in, and others that are completely not taken in, that are just calling this grift, theft, and what have you. So the aspiration is a legitimate one and has been since the 50s when computers first became readily available for people to ponder and think about, that, you know, eventually will people be able to somehow configure them to simulate a human mind? That's asking a lot, because ultimately we know next to nothing about the human mind. We know just very basic concepts of it. But the nitty-gritty and exactly how and where memories are imprinted and how stable they are and what affects them and all the other nuances are mostly a mystery. We barely begin to guess what sleeping entails. Recently, there was a research article that demonstrated that neurophysiological mechanism for kind of flushing the brain at night while we're asleep. But, I mean, I'm sure there are many other things going on simultaneously. So, you know, the problem is trying to simulate something that we at this point don't understand. It's going to make it either incredibly difficult, if not impossible. But I understand the aspirations. And I'm saddened by the monetary flim-flam guys who are just abusing people's interest in a subject that warrants the interest, but not necessarily the trillions of dollars at this point.
KD2FIU?
Psychologist. My wife. A human being is pressing the button, and he expects reaction of the mechanism or any kind of action. And then when he presses the same button, he wants that to be repeated. But when you're trying to scratch your head and instead you're scratching your butt, but you're scratching, then you're not surprised. I was trying to scratch my head. So that was, that is artificial intelligence. You ask the question, or you triggering the action, and you're trying to find out how close the previous response is to the response month later. back to you.
Okay, but I mean, that's part of what the training philosophy is, too. There are a lot of parameters. I think the most recent mythos, AI, has a trillion parameters, and you're adjusting the probability in those parameters so that you get the correct, consistent responses. So, you know, usually that type of training leads to the same type of answer or a similar one, because, again, we're not really dealing with facts as much as we're dealing with probability.
KD2FRU?
Yes, George.
Something was presented to me by somebody 28 years old who is a PhD. He just got his PhD, and he is involved with radiation, and he also is somebody who instructs at the university that he had left and is moving on into industry. And he said AI is a problem. Why is it a problem? Because he had given them an assignment. He had given 16 students an assignment. And to come back with the actual development of certain radiation, its applications and technology, the speeds that it was done at, everything, all along the line, whether it was successful, it was going on. He did this for 3 months. And he found that most of what was coming back from the students was wrong. And he said he spent a lot of time off on his own time, studying and finding that the information that three-quarters of the students was using was on websites that were AI-controlled.
Agree with you. Like I said, it's Swiss cheese. Sometimes it gets things right, but other times it gets things wrong. I shared with everyone on this technical net the history of image production, that AIs are not trained on things that we amateur radio operators are aware of. And so I have this perpetual test. I've given it to all the generative image producers. You know, draw me a three-element Yagi. Not a single one come vaguely close. Sometimes I will describe it in minute detail, and it will have the components, but they'll be arranged in the wrong places and such. So, again, you know, some answers are better than others. Can you rely on them? No. Unfortunately, they tend to hallucinate a couple of percentage points, but that's very important. If you want to know something about something, you can't have it be 5% wrong. So I agree with you. It is deeply flawed. I believe that, unfortunately, generative transform methods have limitations that the programmers kind of refuse to admit, and so they're going to scale it all the way up as much as they possibly can. And, you know, because they don't think they're going to hit a wall, and I think they're going to hit a wall. But that's the way it is right now. You know, unfortunately, it is a flawed technology.
Roy, and to really go back on this, this person was 28 years old, not our age. So it was somebody who's saying he doesn't like it at all. In the fact that he did all of his education on his own without something like this, and he is trying to not only go forward with his career, but he is also concerned that the people he's trying to educate, very smart young man, by the way, he is trying to say that he fears it.
As well as he should, unfortunately. There's more than a few studies out there that kind of demonstrate that the old adage, if you don't use it, you lose it. If you don't use your analytical mind, if you just hand it over to a prompt, eventually your own built-in abilities will diminish over time. So that's a troubling piece of research so far. This might be the true dumbing of the human race.
Thank you, Roy. KD2FIU clear.
Okie doke, George. I think we're boring some strange guy who has nothing else to do with his life and generate noise on a repeater. If anyone has any further comments, please hit that push to talk. Otherwise, we'll move on to the main segment.
PHG to close.
Okay, Jim.
I think we're talking about some of the most relevant stuff of the day. Proceed.
Okay, I mean, that's why I put it at the top, because it's in the news every week, and it affects us politically, economically, and just as a human race. And thankfully, I get enough responses from you and other people listening to make it a viable segment. It's sort of the same thing that when COVID was impacting all of our lives. We took some time off to discuss COVID, even though I had some kind of strange responses from some people who thought that this was some kind of strange Democratic party hack or some such nonsense. But nevertheless, I agree with you, Jim.
Proceed.
This is AC2GS, and this is the Weimar Technical Net, and if anyone has any questions, comments, or topics, preferably related at first, but we'll do science and technology, and if anyone has multiple segments, and it's going to take some time, try to get yourself listed at the end of the list instead of the beginning of the list, so people with simple questions can get simple answers and move on. Anyone with any of these things, hit that push to talk. You give me your first name, your call sign, whether it's amateur radio related or science and technology.
K2NE, Sam, and this is radio related.
N2XN, ham radio related.
November 2, Zulu Charlie, John, amateur radio related.
KF2CZ, Brian, radio related.
Okay, Sam recognized, Wes recognized, John recognized, and Brian recognized. Anyone else want to put your name?
K2HZ, Bronx, New York City. Just listening and enjoying the net. Very interesting tonight.
Okay, very good. Sit back, relax, and listen. And if you ever have a question or a comment, feel free. Okay, Sam, what do you got for us tonight?
Thank you, Roy. Thank you, group. It was a very fascinating and interesting discussion on AI tonight. My questions are going to be short and sweet, and hopefully you can help me understand. Yesterday I put up a vertical antenna, and to reach my shack, I had a 75-foot cable, coax, and to it, I added a 25-foot coax to actually reach my rig. And the SWR was, you know, forget about it, over 10. It was like ridiculous on the analyzer. When I switched to a 75-foot cable and used 2 3-foot jumpers, so a total of 81, the SWR dropped down to 1.3, 1.4 without a tuner. So I'm trying to understand what was wrong and why with what using the 75 and the 25 as opposed to 75 with 2 and 3 for jumpers? That's the first question. And the second question is, since I have 75 plus 3 and 3, which equals 81, if I want to get a cable to replace it, so I have one continuous coax, would you recommend I get an 85-foot coax cable or a 100-foot cable? Anyway, back to you, Roy. Those are one or two other quick questions, but that's the gist of what I really need to know. Thank you.
Okay. Since you already know that it works for 85 feet length of coaxial cable, I think you'd be better off if you started with something close to that 81 feet. If the closest you can get is 85, then 85. So that's the second answer to the second question. Let's go back to the first question. If you have a resident correctly tuned antenna, the length of the transmission line has no effect on impedances. If you have a mismatch, then it does. As you increase the length of the transmission line, the impedance will actually... impedance is a vector. It is not only a number of ohms. That's a scalar entity. You know, you want a 50-ohm antenna. You want a 50-ohm impedance, so that's the scalar absolute, 50 ohms. In fact, what impedance is both a scalar, 50 ohms, and what is the direction? Is it 0 degrees? Is it 90 degrees? 180 degrees? And the number of degrees will rotate as it travels along your transmission line. So I've never quite had that type of severe situation that you have. I've mentioned before that I've had situations where my antenna tuner could not tune my antenna, and I put in an additional, I think it was a 15 feet of cable that rotated its impedance such that it was now capable of the antenna tuner handling it and transforming it to a 50-ohm impedance. So the bottom line is, because your antenna is not perfectly resonant, the length will affect its impedance. It'll change over the length of the coax cable. So you just happen to find a optimal length where the rotation landed back in some place that you could deal with it, 81 feet. So I would stay around the 81 feet unless you kind of change significantly the condition of the antenna itself. As long as all things remain the same, if you change the length of the transmission line, you will rotate the impedance out of range again.
Thank you. I got it. Quick second question, or third question at this point. Today, at the 10-meter net, you saw that I used my hex beam, and then I used the vertical, and the vertical was significantly weaker signal getting out, even though my SWRs on both were good. Can you kind of explain to me the relationship between the signal strength and the SWR?
Okay. There is pretty much no correlation between the two. SWR is simply an indication that your antenna is providing a 50-ohm impedance source to your coaxial cable. If it's not, if it's for whatever reason, if it's off resonance and it was reading a 100-ohm impedance, you would have a 2-to-1 VSWR. If it was reading an impedance of 400 ohms, it would be an 8-to-1. So it's only measuring the impedance mismatch. Now, impedance mismatch causes reflections and causes less energy transfer from your transmitter to the antenna. So generally speaking, the worse your SWR is, the less efficiently you're transferring energy, the lower your output signal is. That's one part. now, you know, how much of your of the signal that you get to the antenna is going to produce radio waves and people will hear you? It depends. If you connect a dummy load is essentially a 50-ohm non-inductive resistance. It'll show you an SWR of 1:1. But the better your dummy load is, the less radiation will be released from it. Even some of the best dummy loads are a little leaky, so they'll produce a little RF. But for all intents and purposes, a dummy load is a wonderful example of a thing with a perfect SWR and a lousy efficiency. It should have an efficiency close to 0%. So your antenna's efficiency is a function of a bunch of different things. What is the radiation resistance designed into the antenna? Depends upon whether it's a full-length resonant antenna or a shortened one with a loading coil, or it has a capacitive pack. Another thing is not just how efficient it is, but how it deals with the radiation. Does it provide radiation generally across the area that you're operating, or is it highly focused? Are there null points? Are there, there could be a, it could be favoring the ocean and not the coast, and unless you get a lot of communication from Europe, you're not really going to talk to too many people. So it's the directionality and the efficiency that provides the primary basis for how good your antenna is. SWR is just a measurement of impedance. The problem is that it's a lot easier to measure impedances and SWRs, so everyone knows their SWR. It is incredibly more difficult to figure out the efficiency of an antenna and its directionality, which is why almost no one knows what theirs are.
KD2FIU.
Yes, George.
All right, back to Sam's original question about the vertical and the 75 and 25 foot cables. 10:1 is broken. Whether you're adding two jumpers to the 75, doesn't matter. Whether you get 2:1, 1.5:1, 1.1:1, 10:1 is broken. Either the 25 was broken or any interconnections you were making at the time was broken. Let's clarify that for anybody who understands or is listening right now. You're not going to get such a difference by changing the specific length from 100 to 81 or 75 to 81. It's not going to happen with 50-ohm cables. You may go from 1.5 to 2 to 3 to 1, but 10:1 is broken. So you as I got back to you, Sam, test from the antenna device itself and come backwards. But the actual thing that you did by changing the interconnections, by unscrewing, screwing whatever, or even if the 25-foot jumper itself was bad, people got to understand out there, the precise little difference of everything is not going to change a 10:1 to resonance. KD2FIU.
Thank you, George, and thank you, Roy. I think I learned a little bit more about the science of amateur radio. Have a good night. I'll be standing by, and thank you for taking the questions, Roy.
Okie doke. Very good, Sam. Thank you for participating. Next on our list is John. What do you have for us tonight, John?
Yeah, good evening, Roy. Good evening, Matt. Roy, I just want to ask you a quick question. We were talking about the common mode currents last week. And, you know, we're all familiar with the theory with coax, the common mode traveling down the inside of the shield. We're using twin lead, and you're getting the common mode back. What path is that taking? Is that just pushing back on the RF current going to the antenna? They don't. What is the theory on the travel of that?
Don, that is a great question, which means I don't have the faintest clue. I've never really seen anyone discuss common mode in terms of open water. And I can't imagine a third conductor. You know, most people don't consider the fact that coax shielding is two-sided, and you're able to have two separate currents on two separate surfaces of the shielding. But I can't imagine any kind of structure operating as a third conductor on an open wire. That's a good question.
Hi, Roy. I'm going to try to do more research on it. I never came across anything. I'll dig deeper. If I come up with anything, I'll bring it back to Net, and I know you will too. So it was just something I was, pondering in the many ponderings that we do of antenna theory. And just a final note, again, the AI seems to be something everyone enjoys, and it's getting bigger and bigger, and that's a good thing. So thank you again, Roy. AT2GS, November 2, Zulu Charlie.
You're welcome, and I will look it up as well, and we'll compare our notes. Okay, Brian, you're next. What do you got for us tonight?
I was reading a website. I forgot the name of the company, but they're developing a fusion reactor that they're in England, actually. They're developing a fusion reactor that is just a fraction of the size that they're doing in France with the ITER fusion reactor. I forgot the name of the company, but it fits in a room. Instead of going ahead and heating it up, with lasers, I'm not exactly 100% sure, but they're doing it differently. They're hitting it simultaneously with one big boom with lasers. Have you heard about this, and is there any scientific progress regarding this particular prototype?
Not to my knowledge. There has yet to be reported in any case the ability to extract more energy out of a fusion reactor than they had to put into it to create the burst output. And that's what they're always looking for. They kind of faked it a couple of years ago because they took not the total amount of energy that was thrown into the reactor, the amount of energy that was created by the laser in the reactor. And since the laser was about 1% efficient, it was a lot easier for them to be able to do that. But as far as I'm aware, there is yet to be anything that will produce more energy out than you put in.
How many years down the road do you think before this is sustained magnitude reaction, something of, real magnitude that's going to go ahead and prove this?
People have been quoting 20 years in the future for the last 60 years.
Kind of what I thought, too. It's been promoted. Basically what it is the containment. And this company in Britain does not use a magnetic containment for the plasma. What they do is they just shoot it directly at the deuterium or tritium, I think it's deuterium, and they just shoot the laser simultaneously at the piece of deuterium. and bring it up to a very, very high temperature. So they're not really worried too much about plasma containment. I just want to know if this sounds scientifically feasible or if it's just another experimental step.
I think it's feasible. The problem is it's not reproducible. You can't use that type of a mechanism to continuously generate power output from a reactor. And the previous experiments kind of show that. It's not like they can set up actions in the same day. Usually it takes them a month or two to reset everything and to industrialize, you know, to have the tool shop build the enclosures over again because it blows a lot of the equipment to shreds. So it's not feasible for a long-term and power output. It's an experiment to see if you can kind of get more power out than you put in, but not in a way that's reproducible on a day-by-day type of situation. So even if I snapped the magic fingers and gave them, 200% yield on their power output, they could deploy it to something that we could use for power. It just would take too long to set everything up and probably be cost prohibitive. And eventually, due to metal fatigue, the whole thing would probably collapse after X number of experimental bursts.
Okay, so last comment. Is it more of a question of containment, or is it more of a question of ignition, or does it actually have to do with both in the end?
I would say it has to do with both. You have to meet strict criteria for concentration, density, and power output. And then you have to kind of figure out how to deal with the results in a relatively non-destructive manner. You have to channel that energy into some more constant, steady state, manageable way than it presently is provided. It's just a big boom and it's all over. And you can't kind of reset things in an hour or two. So. Yeah, there's a lot of problems. But again, these are people legitimately looking to invent a useful fusion electrical generator and more trying to break a record that might get them a Nobel Prize on a good day, but certainly isn't going to lead to a major fusion generator in your neighborhood.
Okay, thank you very much for the explanation, much appreciated, and I'll turn it back to you.
Okay, Doug Bryan, thank you for your participation. Wesley, what do you got for us?
Yeah, first I would like to say a few words about the common mode in open wire. So, in open wire line, because we discussed it just a few minutes ago. So in open wires, common mode refers to the situation where both wires move together relative to environment. So that would be earth or nearby metal. So this mode is characterized by equal currents flowing in the same direction on both wires, which can lead to increased noise pickup and radiation. And the common mode impedance is not defined by the wire-to-wire spacing, but rather by tapping to the ground or nearby objects. Even a small current imbalance can create common mode current, which can radiate and pick up noise more readily compared to the differential mode. So there was a few words about that. Let me drop it. The first object to discuss was in International Ham Day that was sent here 10 hours ago when I sent you email. International Ham Day. It appears that we have two, not one, and very close one to each other. And if you don't mind to say a few words about that and word ham, what it means. Dr. Ray, back to you.
I got thrown off of All-Star again.
Did you hear what I said?
I got thrown off of All-Star again. Are you out there, Wes?
Yes, I am. I was waiting for your... I gave mic back to you. I was talking about International Ham Day. That was 10 hours ago when I sent the email back to you.
Oh, okay. There's lots of international whatever days. I tend to discount them all. But, you know, you want to celebrate it, feel free.
Glaze Spiral Ham Day. And then we have
it looks like it was the obligatory name given to ham radio operators in 1990. And what I found, I'm gonna just read the note. Additionally, ham can also refer to an actor who overreacts or hams in it up on stage, drawing attention to themselves and being overly dramatic in their performance. In this sense, someone who is described as ham is seen as being overly theatrical and whatever. So overall, ham is a word with multiple meanings that can refer to type of meat, style of acting, or manner of behavior. And in many languages, not the pleasant word. So, they're being called hams. So, let me drop.
Yeah, Wes, for whatever reason, your audio is a bit down. So either your microphone is faulty or someone's transmitting an empty carrier or something's going on.
Okay, hold on. Okay, it should be good right now. Okay, so I'm not sure how much of the transmission went through. Back to you, Doctor.
Well, if everyone's increased their volume, they could hear you. It just was very, 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 very low. Years ago, I looked up the etiology of ham. My best guess at the time, and I have no reason to change it, is that that reason. There's no fundamentally absolute that's the cause of it. It just kind of got introduced into the language. So, and, you know, if it did for that reason, again, six of one, half a dozen of the other. It's of little to no consequence, you know. Amateur radio operators have made it their own, which is probably the best way of dealing with anything that is meant to be insulting.
Okay. So how do you receive me right now? How is my sound?
It's nice and loud.
Okay, fine. So the next one would be... first, there is a quote. It takes 22.5 hours to reach Earth from Voyager 1. The speed of electromagnetic wave traveling from Voyager to Earth is exactly the same as speed of light in a vacuum. So by that we may say that I'm trying to make a humoristic phrase when talking about FT2 and FT8, because we're talking about the speed of information. Dr. Roy, what is the speed of information transfer to the brain of an average ham radio operator? Is it better when he scratches his head within 3.8 seconds, or is it better if he scratches his head within 15 seconds? And that is exactly the difference between speed of FT2 and FT8. Back to you, Dr. Roy.
Okay, not quite sure where you were going with this email. Again, doesn't make that much sense to me. The symbol rate of FT8 is not based on the sensory of brain function. You have to get someone with a lot of brain in damage to have speed limitations the same as FT8. FT8 has a slow symbol rate, not because it's required for people to spend that much time thinking about, you know, what hello means. It's simply that there are redundancies and error correction included in the transmission of FT8 so that you can pick it up below your noise floor, which impacts upon the effective symbol rate and makes it slow as molasses. You know, for you know, getting wallpaper, it's fine, but if you're having a conversation like JS8 call, it's slow and tedious, and so we can pick up, you know, I mean, how fast can I speak before you can't figure out what the hell I'm saying? You know, we can pick up a lot of information in a short time, and, you know, if you want to just do it on Morse code, you know, there are guys who are able to receive it's 40, 50 words per minute or something, so that's probably audio signal. Visual signals have a much wider bandwidth. You can discern a great deal more information from a image than you can from a sound. So, you know, this is a complicated, interesting idea that has pretty much nothing to do with FT8 or FT4 or FT2.
Thank you very much for that. Well, actually, I was trying to find when do we need such a fast information transfer. But, of course, I was puzzled with how fast information gets to the brain. So let's say somebody's eating very fast. And then how fast the brain is able to notice that he's full. He shouldn't eat more. So that is one part of the question. The second one is, well, we have electromagnetic waves, so we have internet, and we're sending the information. And then we notice that we have FT2 and FT8, and we know that FT2 is much faster. Where do we meet FT2? Back to you, Andrew.
The people, Frank and Taylor, designed it for those people who the signals that they were working with are not below their noise floor, and so they could quicken the rate of exchanges. Again, using legitimate FT8, it can be kind of glacial. It synchronizes to the minute, and so you're not going to get a response for another minute. So you send out, that you're there, and you sit there and you stare at the screen for the next minute or so. You know, there was once a gentleman who sat in the chat room here on during the technical net and did FT8 at the same time, and unfortunately he found it to be not a very enjoyable experience. It was too automated for him at the time. But again, that's probably simply because there are some people who, look, I'm sending a message to someone who's not not that difficult to reach, and I don't need the redundancy and slow symbol rate. Can you give me one that I can turn up if I have a strong signal? And so they did it. That would be my surmise. I don't know. I don't really sit around and hang out in their forums, so I don't know.
Okay. Well, also the impression that if we have limited time and we want to get from point A to point B the most of the information, like communication between Voyager and the Earth or International Space Station and the Earth, then of course the fastest is the mode, the better for us in any terms. But for the ham radio, that is pure pleasure, or it is supposed to be pure pleasure. The question is, where are we going with you?
Again, it sort of depends on what's the most important aspect to your transmission. With NASA, I'm sure they would prefer going in normal rate. There are some ships that are so far away, that are so underpowered, that they've cranked down the symbol rate so that they've been able to diminish some of the background noise and get the signal. Same thing with FP8. FP8 isn't for me. I don't need wallpaper. I don't need to play tag. And I don't need to sit there and wait for an automated system to do its own thing. You don't really need a human being to do FP8. I understand people like wallpaper. They like tagging base. And so they do it. They suffer the delays inherent in FP8 in order to increase their ability to get more call signs.
Okay. Next one, Anam G2. Anam, Anam, whichever we say it, G2. We spoke, we exchanged emails in this matter. I was kind of puzzled with the origin, and back to you, Dr. Roy, for your comment.
I assume you're alluding to a company called Anon. They make Apache Lab software-defined radios. They're based, as far as I understand, in India. They might have distribution points all over the world. And they manufacture an SDR that was initially designed by the Tapper Group, the Tucson Packet Radio Group, or whatever the hell it was called. And they're still around, and I think once a year they get together and hold a symposium and issue papers on the design of software-defined radios and digital radios and such. But they originally designed these SDRs. They have open-source to control them. And Anon manufactures and sells them. I think they've upgraded them a little bit. They increase the output to transistors so that the transmitter puts out, 200 watts instead of 100 watts or something. But, I mean, other than that, I'm not aware of any sophisticated upgrade in their design parameters. But, like I said, most likely, they are an Indian country, an Indian company. My assessment is that it's a worldwide distribution network, so as time goes on, they set up distribution networks in Australia for, Asia, and they probably have one for the United States and Canada. There's a lot of other little companies that do the same thing.
Okay. So, talking about the price, $4,145. Nice looking radio, 8-inch screen. And they are not consistent. So they have a front plate that looks different on the picture on their website page, different on some videos, it's like they were trying to improve the product, or they downgraded to the plain face of the radio due to the cost. I don't know. I'm not sure. But they have ANN or ANN, ANAN, ANAN, 10, 100, 100D, and 200D. So they have range of devices. Anyhow, somebody wants to spend the money. $4,000 and change, you can actually try to buy a good ESO or Kenwood for that money. That's my 5 cents. The next one would be unexplained yet. Let me jump. Okay. There are 10 individuals linked to U.S. nuclear weapons, aerospace, and advanced fusion research. And they disappeared. Dr. Roy, back to you, Enter J.
Yeah, I really don't know what to do with things like this. Again, you're not bringing me something that was sourced by the New York Times. You're bringing me something from India Times. The India Times had lots of stuff on that room temperature superconductor, too. So, you know, you keep bringing me stuff from New York Post and India Times and Lithuania Express and God knows what else. Unfortunately, my general opinion is it's probably BS. So I don't know what to make of it, and I don't really care.
Well, unfortunately, it is not BS. Yesterday, comments of Trump, as far as those missing scientists, I'm quoting it, I think we're going to have an answer next week. So we have 10 people, and they are either related to UFO, and they vanished, or they died, but died in a strange way. So we have Michael David Hicks, NASA. Frank Myward, NASA. Carl Grimlar, NASA, Caltech. William Merrill McCasant, retired Air Force Major General, vanished February 2026 near Albuquerque, New Mexico. Steven Garcia, government contractor. Monica Justino Reza, NASA, JPL. Anthony Chavez, Los Alamos National Lab. Melissa Kaiser, the same. John Thomas, Pharmaceutical Research. And Nuno Lurio, MIT Plasma Science and Fusion Center. Back to you.
As long as the only person writing about it is the India Times, lots of luck. Have fun. Yeah.
No, those people are listed not in India Times. They are listed in many other places and very much legitimate ones. And also they were mentioned by a White House and President of our country. Back to you.
Oh, well, he wouldn't lie, would he?
I love your response. Okay. Let's go to the next one. I'm going to need the help from some people who are fluent, experienced with air conditioners. There are many air conditioners, and I have a need to exchange fuel. So we have something that is extremely quiet, that would be 31 dBs, U-shape, Midea, I don't know how to probably say it, and General Electric, that would be GE also. But this one is inverted U or
lowercase N-shape profile. So those are very much quiet one, General Electric is 45 dB, so it's a little bit louder. But those are, there are also